Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The death of George Floyd while in police custody in Minneapolis last month has not only resulted in protests and an examination of police interactions with African Americans, it has been the catalyst for conversations about racial inequality and injustice in other areas as well. Starting tonight, WITF is looking to engage the community with a bi-weekly summer series of virtual community conversations to address systemic racism and injustice. The Toward Racial Justice, a Conversation on Systemic Racism series will be a forum for essential discussions about race and racism, its effects on housing, education, finance, healthcare, relations with police, and inequality. The series begins tonight at 7 on WITF's YouTube channel. Now, you can learn more and register to attend at WITF.org/events. We're going to learn about the series on the first segment of today's program. Joining us is Charles Ellison, executive and producer and host of Reality Check, a daily public affairs program on WURD Radio in Philadelphia. He will be facilitating the Toward Racial Justice conversations. Mr. Ellison, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Major Crystal M. Turner Childs, Director of the Bureau of Forensic Services with the Pennsylvania State Police. She also is a WITF board member. Major Turner Childs, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Major Turner Childs, I'm going to start with you. How did this series come to be?
Wow. Many of us have seen all of the events that have unfolded over the past few weeks, and we were all trying to figure out how we could utilize WITF in a manner that would be supportive, in a manner that would be able to bring about change, and in a manner that would include the community's input. And so we sat down, we talked about it, a group of us sat down and talked about it with WITF at the lead and made the decision to come up with this type of format. We think that having dialogue that includes the community, especially regarding the community, is the best way for us to move forward and to come up with some real solid plans on how we move policing forward.
So you said move policing forward?
Move policing forward and the community, as well as talk about how race involves other demographics as well. We're talking about in healthcare. We're talking about in industries such as banking, how housing. We're talking about all types of demographics that race has a focus, not just a focus, but you know, somehow people that are people of color are disenfranchised, and so we want to make sure that we hit all of those topics.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to point out is that this conversation over six different programs is not just about policing, even though that will be a major component of it. It involves a lot of the other topics having to do with racism, inequality, a lot of other issues. But what are the goals of the Toward Racial Justice series? What are the goals as you see them?
I believe our goals are to have a civil discourse, to be able to sit down and really hear one another, to start to understand and appreciate and be empathetic about how race affects us in all different areas of our life. And I think that this is a good way to get started. We're asking the community to provide input, and we're also looking for people out there in the community to just to help us get started.
Doing this virtually rather than in person, does that make it more difficult, less difficult, or don't we know?
I don't think we know yet, but I'll tell you what. I think it opens it up to some people excuse me, that wouldn't have the ability to participate. You know, sometimes when we have town halls, we only have room for a certain amount of people. I think this way, doing it this way, we're going to be able to just get information from a variety of people that we probably normally wouldn't be able to touch. So we're gonna see how it goes. I'm looking forward to it.
Charles Ellison, as the facilitator leading this conversation, how do you see your role and what do you want to touch on?
Right. So, you know, as the maxim goes, carpe diem, right? So seize the day. And I think that we have a big moment in our history, a big moment as a nation and also as a commonwealth, more specifically a big state, a really crucial state in a year like this, like Pennsylvania, to seize the day. And so I'm real honored to play a role to bridge the different perspectives, but also to really get into some deep dive conversations about, okay, well, how do we perceive and how do we define racism? Because I think that's what's really different, just dramatically different about this moment from, say, previous moments, whether that was Baltimore or Ferguson or the Flashpoint back in the 90s. You know, some of us were growing up at that time in the wake of Rodney King and the acquittal of those officers. So it's, you know, I kind of see this as an opportunity to really take the conversation to the next level. And as the major was saying, out of this conversation, getting into a mapping session and a planning session about really actionable items that can start the process of dismantling and eliminating systemic racism. Because, you know, moral imperative aside, Scott, racism is not a sustainable business model for our nation. It's not a sustainable business model for our society. It's very costly. So, you know, that's why I think it's really, you know, I'm glad WITF is facilitating this and has asked me to moderate. And I have these conversations every day on a regular basis on a talk radio station like WURD in Philly. It's just going to be so important to also lay out that business case and just to also, you know, persuade the larger public that, hey, listen, we can't go on this path any longer because it's very destructive. It's very destructive for the populations it targets. And that it maliciously attacks every day, every hour, every minute, and is dangerous for the people who also benefit from it or who may not notice it, who aren't victims of it. But, you know, they also need to recognize that they need to be partners in helping dismantling systemic racism. So I think that, you know, my role will be to also make sure that this conversation is holistic and complete, that we're looking at a variety of different areas, because racism is pernicious and it's pervasive in a lot of different facets, whether it's policing or the economy or the environment or education. So I think the first step is having a comprehensive conversation, and that's what I'm looking forward to.
You know, I think that something you just said, many people probably haven't thought of that or even heard it before, that this isn't a sustainable model. There may be people who looked at it and said, well, it's sustained the United States for over 200 years, but thinking of it in those terms may change some people's minds. But something I wanted to bring up, you called this a moment. The subjects related to race in this country have been some of the most difficult conversations that we've ever had. And except on just a few occasions, and you mentioned some of them, we just don't have them. In this country, it is a topic that often doesn't get discussed. But this time, it feels different. Is it? And what's different?
You know, it's, you know, one, it starts with, you know, kind of the age that we live in. We live in this this hyper-digital age where information is easily attainable, and so now we're able to see vivid images of the brutality, the violence of racism in a way that is just very accessible and is very different from how it's been before. So everyone, for the most part, saw that horrific 9-minute tape or video of George Floyd being murdered. It was just cruel. It was vicious. It was inhumane. Everyone saw it. So, and one thing I keep hearing from a lot of folks who, and I wasn't growing up at that time. I'm Gen X, but talking to parents and grandparents who grew up during the civil rights movement in the 50s and the 60s and early 70s, and they're saying, you know what? When we were marching and protesting, you know, it, for the most part, it was just it was mainly us out there. It was mainly black folks who were out there in those protests. Something they're noticing that something's very different. This, and there's a lot of white people out there joining us. So it seems like there's this big reckoning moment for white communities, but also a recognition moment. And that presents an opportunity. So I think that now is the time, too, to transition the conversations from, because we've had conversations about race for a long time. What's different about this, too, is that now we're transitioning into a conversation about racism. And that's different. You know, no longer are we need to stop having conversations really about how we can get along. We've had those ad nauseum. And those are great, but we really need to get to brass knuckles and identify and start dismantling racism, the more systemic, pernicious virus that is infecting America as bad as COVID-19. And we really need to exercise that out of society, because if this keeps up, the consequences are going to be really grave, and it's not going to work out for anyone.
You said right at the very beginning that we have to define racism. Is that something you ask the people participating in this forum to define racism?
Yes, I think that's extremely important that we have a good working definition of racism. So, you know, everyone's on the same page about that. You know, one of the things I noticed growing up, especially I was growing up in the 80s and the early 90s, and we tended to define racism as, hey, you know, the ugly things that people say to you, you know, just the sort of in polite, you know, name calling, you know, calling the person the N-word. And so people started to see racism as sort of that, just that overt thing. But no, it's the microaggressions at the workplace. It's the disparities. It's, you know, it's the housing segregation that's still there, the educational segregation, the disparity in funding between majority black school districts like one in Philly and majority white suburban school districts like in Montgomery County neighboring it. So, you know, it's all of that, and we need to start unpacking all of that and understanding that racism is very active. It's overt, it's subtle, it's covert. You know, we do have prejudices that we all harbor, and that's something that's going to be a long sort of soul-searching spiritual process. But one thing we can talk about and we can start actively dismantling through conversation and also policymaking is racism. We've got to figure out a way to navigate ourselves, our society, our collective communities out of that paradigm.
We have an email from Chris in Marietta who says, should we think about revamping of the education system to provide accurate history lessons as compared to what was used in the past? I feel the education system is a good place to start. We're hearing much more conversation about history and what we have not learned in history. And now I'll be specific. I mean, President Trump is having this rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Saturday. There's been a lot of discussion about what many Americans, most Americans, don't know about that massacre, racial massacre in Tulsa back in 1921. The point that Chris is making about education, is that a good place to start? Is it one of the places to start?
I believe it is. I believe it's an excellent place to start. Again, just like, you know, the Juneteenth, learning about Juneteenth, learning about all the historical breakthroughs that have been made by people of color would be the truth about historical breakthroughs about people of color. Learning, you know, about kings and queens that come from Africa, those would be amazing things, ways to start, and embracing it and not just looking at it as 1 month in February, that's where we learn about African-Americans or anybody of color. We should embrace educational, change the way we do an educational curriculum for all people of color and how it affects what we do here in this America, this United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point. I think this is going to be one of the key activities that we need to engage in. There does need to be like a complete overhaul and requiring and mandating deeper dive history lessons and curriculum. But the Southern Poverty Law Center, I just remember that back about a couple of years ago, did a copious study on how, like, you high school students understand the history behind the Civil War, for example. You still have pluralities of Americans who think the Confederate flag is about Southern heritage. No, it's about treason. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Just full stop. And so, you know, people need to understand that history completely. For example, the massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the destruction of Black Wall Street, when people saw that episode, that first episode of Watchmen on HBO, a lot of people actually thought, I saw this, I had a lot of black people and white people admit to me, they thought that that was science fiction. They thought that that was something that was a dramatization that was made up for that show. I'm like, no, that actually happened.
Yeah.
So imagine if people understood that that actually happened in Tulsa, they would know, hey, you know what, we probably shouldn't hold a political rally of this dimension here.
Agreed.
Well, it took a little while before that was realized, but anyway, it's coming up tonight, Toward Racial Justice, the first episode coming up tonight. It's a virtual town hall meeting, I guess you could describe it, opportunity to engage on subjects of race, racism, inequality, and just having this conversation with Major Crystal Turner Childs and Charles Ellison today, probably a lot of people are excited about participating tonight, and you can do that by going to WITF.org/events. It starts tonight at 7 on WITF's YouTube channel. Charles Ellison, executive and producer and host of Reality Check, a daily public affairs program on WURD Radio in Philadelphia, and Major Crystal Turner Childs, director of the Bureau of Forensic Services with the Pennsylvania State Police, and a WITF board member. Thank both of you for being with us today and the work that you're going to be doing over the next few weeks.
Really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. As states begin to ease coronavirus-related restrictions, the economy is sending signals, maybe even slightly, of a potential recovery. Some experts are saying the numbers show what could be a slow and prolonged recovery. Joining us to talk about this as it relates to employment is Michael Horrigan, president of the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Mr. Horrigan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Michael Horrigan, states are starting to open, but the damage has been done in many cases. This downturn, and I hate to even call it downturn because that seems so inadequate, but caused by the COVID-19 pandemic has been described as the worst since the Great Depression in terms of employment. Does this compare with the Great Depression?
In terms of just the magnitude of employment loss and the sudden rise in unemployment, it's obviously a very different circumstance. And I think the thing that people are really wondering about is how quickly will the economy recover once the states begin to reopen and we can reopen safely. One of the points I wanted to make, just in terms of the level of harm that the economy has seen, is last month, in April, we had an unemployment rate of 14.7%, and then last month it was 13.3%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which puts out that number, one of the things that they noted is that they had a misclassification issue of people who probably should have been labeled as unemployed, but were employed but absent from work. And so they actually estimate that the unemployment rate should have been about 5 percentage points higher in April and 3 percentage points higher in May. So these are very high unemployment rate numbers.
Yeah, I had to say that when I heard those numbers for both April and May, my first thought was, boy, that seems awful low. And that's just an observational thing of the number of people you know who have lost their jobs or businesses that have shut down. So if the unemployment rate isn't accurate, what good is it? I mean, I hate to put it so bluntly, but is it helpful to have those unemployment numbers? And what does that data tell us?
So just sort of truth in advertising, I was in charge of those programs for many years.
Oh, I know.
I think the unemployment rate is very accurate. One of the things I praise the Bureau for is their transparency when there is an issue. But the unemployment rate is cyclically very sensitive. It is a good macroeconomic indicator. It will tell you whether or not the economy is going into recovery, whether or not we're expanding, whether or not we're going into a downturn. But it's not the only measure. That's the thing. You have to look at a variety of measures. You mentioned employment. There's a whole other survey that looks at the number of people that have lost their jobs off payrolls. That's also a very critical indicator. The other point I want to make just about unemployment is that in this particular period, it's really a little unusual. If you were laid off from your job and you're not searching for work, and a lot of states relax the work search requirements for unemployment insurance, they wanted you to stay home, and you expect to be recalled, you're going to be labeled as unemployed. But if you're laid off from your job and you're not searching for work and you don't expect recall, you're actually going to show up out of the labor force. That's the way it's always been measured. And so there's about 70% of the people who have been laid off, it is estimated, expect to be recalled. So one of the things I'm very concerned about is the 30% of the people who have been laid off who don't expect recall and maybe won't get recalled. What's going to happen to them? How are they going to fare in this economy?
One difference, I used the example of the Great Depression, and there are a lot of differences, but one of the big differences between the 1930s and now is that there are government program safeguards in place, unemployment insurance, compensation, for example, and the government this time expanded that even more for those who were self-employed or own their own companies, right. that kind of thing. But was it enough for what the government did? Was it enough?
You mean it? Well, I think one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is the program that exists that a concern that we have is that firms don't know about it or that they're not taking advantage of it, and that's short-term compensation. That's the ability to, let's just say that you're reopening, but you're not ready to bring your entire payroll back. But you can bring, say, a certain portion of your payroll back for, say, 20 hours a week. It's possible to do that and have people then get unemployment insurance for the hours they don't get, plus they still get that $600 subsidy per week. So it's a very powerful incentive that firms could have in terms of hiring back the workers and getting people back on the job.
You know, 70% of this economy is based on consumer spending. I'm wondering about the psychology of those who are called back to work, those who get new jobs. Are they going to be apt to spend money? It would seem that they would have bills to pay that have backed up, and psychologically they may be leery about spending. So it doesn't seem like that consumer spending part of the economy will come back right away, even once those people do go back to work.
Well, I think with a lot of data, you really have to sort of be patient and see what the next couple of months are going to bring. So, for example, retail sales, the figures came out this week, and in April, they were up 17%. And for non-store retail sales, and I know that I've been doing the same thing, ordering things from my home, those were up 31% from May of 2019 over the last year. So in building and material and garden equipment and supplies, which is, you know, reasonable for this time of year, those were up over 16%. So, you know, I think we need to wait and see how confident consumers are going to be in terms of coming back. I think the other aspect is feeling safe going into a store. And I think firms are trying to do a really good job of creating an environment in which people know what the rules are when they walk in to either get takeout food or they're getting a haircut. And I think firms are very conscious about how they set up their organizations to make it safe for people.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any good news now or on the horizon? I mean, you just mentioned consumer spending. That certainly was a bit of a surprise and was good news. You know, yeah. I know I just asked the question about whether people would be leery, but there also is that segment of the population is like, you know, we've been stuck in the house now for 3 months and, you know, there are some things that we'd like to do. But is there good news now or some on the horizon?
I think there's been partial good news, what I would call cautious good news. So let's just take a look at what happened from March to April. We lost 20.7 million jobs, which was huge. But then from April to May, and payroll employment actually increased by 2.5 million. So we didn't gain back the jobs that we lost, but it was a bit of good news. I think a lot of people were not expecting. So, for example, in construction, if you look at the number of jobs that came back in construction alone, compared to the amount that they've lost since February, they recovered about 44% of the jobs they lost. That's big. And a lot of states have been reopening construction projects, and construction managers that I've talked to, they have real rules in place in terms of how they get their workers back in safely. Leisure and hospitality, that's been hit really hard. They've lost over 8 million jobs since February, and they recovered about 15% in 1 month. So there is some cautious good news. The industries that really gained in May were leisure and hospitality, construction, healthcare. You know, a lot of smaller doctor's offices are now seeing patients again, elective surgeries. Retail trade gained back about 16% of their jobs. So there is some cautious good news.
Mm-hmm. And construction, one of the things that strike me about construction is that, you know, we could be talking about housing, and there are so many other industries that are part of the construction puzzle. So that would seem, you say 44% increase, that would seem to be some real good news.
Yeah, it wasn't a 44% increase. It was the percent of jobs that were lost since February.
What percent
of those came back? And that was 44%. You know, one of the construction managers that I was talking to, I was asking, how many jobs are going to come back right now? And he said, well, for me, it's actually going to be over 100%. This is an isolated case. But the point he was making is that he had some construction jobs with incredibly firm deadlines. These were school construction projects. That he had to get back on track quickly because they have to open by September. They also had a lot of construction jobs that continued even during COVID because they were deemed essential, like hospital construction, for example. So one of the things I found was that a lot of these construction managers had a lot of experience with how to work during a pandemic, and they're bringing those principles to play in how they're reopening the non-essential construction projects.
You mentioned the hospitality industry, and I think most people are aware that hospitality, restaurants, hotels was hit really, really hard. But let's look at the other side. I hate to say silver linings. Are there industries that will come back stronger as a result of the pandemic? Maybe some areas, you mentioned healthcare. Are there some industries that may be hiring more people once this is, I hate to say over, but we see some recovery?
You know, I haven't really looked at it from that perspective. I got to say that one of the things that will happen probably is that the nature of jobs may change in terms of how we interact with technology, how we deliver services to consumers. You know, just at least right now, there's a lot of virtual presence going on in just about everything that we do, whether it be ordering food and then picking it up, whether it be having a virtual doctor's appointment. So I think as opposed to saying it's coming back stronger, I just haven't looked at it that way. I think there's going to be a change in the way services are delivered to consumers in the future. You know, you mentioned before about are there any silver linings. One other thing I wanted to point out, I was looking this week at the New York Fed's report. It's called the Empire State Manufacturing Survey. So New York, you know, had that flattening of the curve and then the curve going down, and they've been reopening gradually in the last month. The firms in that survey were notably optimistic that conditions would be better in 6 months. And that the index for future business conditions actually rose to its highest level in more than a decade. So I think that, you know, as you said, there are some silver linings in terms of how people are thinking about what the future is going to bring.
How will states make up for lost revenue with so many people out of work? I mean, this is something that in Pennsylvania right now, the estimate is that Pennsylvania will lose $5 billion in tax revenue. With so many people out of work, there is going to be a ripple effect. I know this is a subject that you've addressed, and this has to be very difficult for states, local municipalities, counties. How are they going to make up that tax revenue for so many people out of work?
Yeah, this is a very serious situation. Tim Bartik, who's one of the senior researchers at Upjohn, has spent a lot of his career looking at this particular issue. And he cites research, which I cited in a publication that I had. Tim cites research that says that if the unemployment rate in a state goes up by 1%, that on average a state would lose about 3.7% of its tax revenue. Or put another way, if the national unemployment rate goes up by 1%, across the country, states collectively lose about $45 billion in revenue. In other words, when the Michigan unemployment rate rises up to 22.7% from March to April, Michigan and all other states are going to have a huge problem in terms of their state budgets. So what do they do? Do they have to curtail services? A lot of these are very essential services in terms of protective services, education, health. Do they raise taxes? And I think there is an argument to be made of, is there a need for government assistance to the states to weather this particular storm? A lot of states have requirements to balance their budgets, whether it be every year or every 2 years. And it's going to be very tough for states to do that with the shortfall they're going to have in revenue.
Well, and something that comes to mind when you talk about curtailing services, for many states, that may be laying off workers. For many school districts, that may be laying off workers and or cutting their labor force, which just goes back to what we were talking about. It's kind of a cyclical thing that you have more people losing their jobs.
Well, and not only that, but you asked the question before about how we were talking about how services may be different in terms of the way they're offered. Think of schools. So schools right now are grappling with the issue of how are they going to reopen, and are they going to have students come back, say, every 3 days or every 2 days? And when they do, will the class sizes be smaller in order to have social distancing? All of that would seem to require that you have to have a flexible process in place to have teachers on board that can handle those smaller class sizes. But if you have states that at the same time are suffering from huge budget pressures, it's going to be hard to do that.
Michael Horrigan is the president of the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Mr. Horrigan, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. One Central Pennsylvania county is working to provide tools for small businesses to jumpstart a recovery and stay safe during the COVID pandemic. Lancaster County is one of only seven in the state to have received direct CARES money from the federal government. County leaders established a grant application program designed to help small business reemerge from the COVID-19 pandemic and also receive free personal protective equipment for employers and their employees. It's called the Lancaster County Economic Recovery Plan. To tell us more about it, Lisa Riggs, president of the Lancaster County Economic Development Company. Ms. Riggs, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, and thanks for having us.
And Tom Baldridge, president and CEO of the Lancaster Chamber. Tom Baldridge, always good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, Scott. Good to talk with you again.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's start with the broad question. How would you describe the Lancaster County Economic Recovery Plan? Who wants to take that one?
I think, Lisa, you should handle that.
I'll jump in first. So the Lancaster County Economic Recovery Plan was presented to the community back at the end of April. And at that time, it was really to provide guidance and to let the business community in Lancaster know that there was a plan that we were going to work together to support businesses in our community as they navigated an extraordinary public health crisis. What we also wanted to emphasize, and what has really held true over the course of the last 6 weeks, is that Lancaster County's business community is built on small business. So the majority of businesses in Lancaster County have 100 and fewer employees, and the vast majority have 20 and fewer employees. these are companies that really, in this sort of extraordinary environment, are struggling to figure out how do they reopen their business, let alone how do they handle their employment base. Do they furlough folks? When do they bring people back? And then on top of that, you add, you know, a lot of questions and uncertainty. You heard it in with your last caller, uncertainty about timing and public health needs. So our whole point was, let's band together as a community and provide as much support as we can to businesses, and especially small businesses. The key piece here is, yes, there's direct financial aid. We'll talk about the grant program a bit. But also things like personal protective equipment. How do you buy it? How do you use it? What are the protocols? And then a whole lot of other informational resources that we now have available on our recoverylancaster.com website. So the whole idea was band together, provide support, and recognize that we have a whole lot of small businesses that really, during this extraordinary time, need the most help.
As I mentioned in the introduction, Lancaster County is one of only seven in the state to have gotten some of this CARE money from the federal government. How did Lancaster County get it? It was based on population, wasn't it?
Yes, counties that in Pennsylvania that had over 500,000 population received it. And that, quite honestly, Scott, was a game changer for our county. The total we received was about $95 million that went to the county commissioners. And then it was in a partnership with them and the economic development company in the chamber that we looked at ways that we could allocate that kind of as strategically and as with as much benefit as possible. So the business community aspect of it took up about $33 million of the $95 million. And then there's other, obviously, governmental costs as well as and very importantly, healthcare aspects, public health mitigation, contact tracing and testing and other matters that were also able to be leveraged through that money.
Yeah, that was one of the things. Lancaster County does not have a health department, at least not yet. And contact tracing is one of the things that this money is being used for. And we're going to have a show on our on one of our shows next week talking about how important contact tracing is. Just thought I'd throw that out there. But there are two parts to this. We'll talk about the grant aspect of it in just a moment. But the PPE equipment, how is PPE part of economic recovery?
I'll tackle that one. You know, in normal circumstances, it wouldn't be. In fact, most of us wouldn't even know what PPE stands for. What we started to hear early is those businesses that were able to stay open, that were considered life-sustaining businesses, couldn't figure out how to get PPE on their own. This is a whole new world. And what are the components? How, you know, is it gloves? Is it masks? At the time, was it thermometers, face shields, all of these sorts of things. We heard that early from businesses. As we realized how many businesses were shut down, and again, how many small businesses are out there, and as we talked to people about the challenges of procuring PPE, that's how this idea came about, is left to their own devices, companies would struggle to figure it out, let alone to get it, and then to incur additional costs at a time where they weren't facing any revenue. So the plan, our bold idea back in April was, could we figure out a way to get PPE to as many businesses as possible? And as Tom mentioned, thankfully the CARES Act money did come to Lancaster County, and so a part of that we carved out a $6 million allocation and said, what if we went out and bulk purchased the PPE and got it into the hands of as many businesses as we can? We've pulled together a team of volunteers that have actually done that and leveraged some really good business acumen in Lancaster County. So just as of yesterday, I think is the latest count I had, we have provided about 3,000 companies in Lancaster County with PPE supply kits. That covers about 33,000 employees, roughly a third of the employment base when we look at companies that have 100 and fewer employees in our community.
Scott, can I just add? Scott,
sure,
can I just add to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
That when you to your question about what's it have to do with economic recovery? I think another important component, which was addressed by your guest prior to us, is frankly the notion of consumer confidence and workforce confidence as well. So, companies that are in a position that appear to be prepared and taking seriously the virus spread threat and doing what they can within their own workplace to mitigate that threat, or in their own restaurant or in their own retail shop, are only going to enhance their chances to breed additional consumer and workplace confidence and help their economic recovery. So it is actually, we think, directly related to the overall economic recovery of Lancaster County and of all those businesses that take this seriously.
I'm just curious, and I hope you could answer this question, but since you did buy it in bulk, I'm curious, was there any part of PPE that was more difficult to obtain than others?
Yes. Specifically, sanitizing wipes are on back order, very difficult to get. And then another area of big concern is for our smaller healthcare providers, so your dental shop or your physical therapy office, or, you know, not your big health systems. Getting N95 masks is virtually impossible. So we've done as best we can in getting most of the other components, but those two items have been challenging. We are very thankful the county's purchasing department has helped us, because they've been procuring PPE for first responders and others in the community already. So their expertise was critical in our ability to get what we did get for our Lancaster County businesses.
So it wasn't
I think those back orders underscore the value of this program, because the fact of the matter is, even with leveraging the purchasing power that the county is able to do, they still were struggling to find the appropriate products. Imagine each individual company trying to do that on their own. I think the scrambling in the back order would be exponentially larger.
Well, I have to say, Tom, that what it reminded me of is just our own family looking for, you know, the wipes that, you know, the shelves are bare. It's so difficult to find. So everybody, even on a larger scale, finding that. I want to switch gears. The Small Business Recovery and Sustainability Fund. It opened Monday. How does it work?
Tom, I'll take this one, too, and jump in. A lot of planning in advance. So you're correct. We have $10 million, which is our first phase. We have $25 million total, but in the first phase, we're doing $10 million. This round is available for any Lancaster County business with 20 and fewer employees. And the way it works is you go on to our website, recoverylancaster.com, and we have a ridiculous amount of information there, frequently asked questions, as well as a step-by-step guide on how to apply. There's an application portal online. That portal is available in English and Spanish. We have a call-in number. That information is also online. And we also have hard copy applications for those folks who either don't have access to the technology or aren't comfortable with the technology. It is an application that allows up to $35,000 for each company, and it's based on a combination of working capital needs, rent, payroll, routine operating costs, things like that, along with costs that either have been incurred or will be incurred related to public health retrofitting. So if you're installing shields or signs or having to reconfigure a space, those costs are also eligible costs. The program is open. The application period opened on Monday, and it closes at 7 o'clock on Friday, not on a first come, first serve basis. So Lancaster County businesses still have time to apply, and we're encouraging any business with 20 and fewer employees to apply in this phase. If they aren't funded in this first phase, we have future phases, and we also have additional resources on our website for other funding sources for small businesses.
So the money, a business would have to, an employer would have to qualify. Because there have been some inconsistencies and some problems with some of the money coming from the federal government. With this, someone would have to prove how they're going to use it or show how they're going to use it. It's not just to say that, hey, we lost $30,000. We want to, make up that $30,000 we lost. They have to show what it's going to be spent on, correct?
They have to provide specific documents like their 2019 tax return to help justify the grant request. So for retrofit as an example, we're actually trying to be fairly lenient with businesses. tell us how you're going to either how you're going to spend the money, or if you spent the money, give us some invoice documentation. So the process itself isn't onerous, but there are, like every program, we have to employ different criteria and eligibility requirements. We know that there is significant demand out there. So part of this first phase, we limited it to companies with 20 employees and fewer. We know there's companies that are larger that need resources too, and we're looking at that for future phases. Just, I really encourage people to go online. The feedback we've had so far over the last couple days is the information there is very clear, and the customer service support that we have available through calls and online services has also been has been really helpful to businesses that are questioning, do they apply or how do they apply?
Now, just to be clear, is this a grant or is it a loan?
It's a grant.
It is a grant, so it does not have to be paid back.
That is correct.
Okay, and it does not go through a bank. This goes directly through you, right?
Correct. The process,
well, through the county.
Technical processes, EDC and the chamber are helping to oversee the application process. The final approval of all the grant recipients will be done at the county by our county commissioners, and then checks will actually be dispersed from the county of Lancaster directly to a business.
Okay. See, what I had in mind was the PPP. Isn't it funny how we're learning all these new things that we didn't know of three
Indeed.
Months ago? and hopefully we never have to hear again after, I don't know, a few months down the road. But that's what I was comparing it to, was the PPP, where businesses had to go through banks rather than go directly. So this is that it would go through through Lancaster County. And just like I asked a few minutes ago about the PPE equipment, what are, in the application process, the businesses who are applying, what are they looking for mostly?
Tom, do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
You know, I mean, we're seeing, I would say so far, and we're being careful because we're still in the middle of the application process, most companies are asking significantly for working capital, especially companies that haven't had any revenue for 2 months. You know, can they have money that will support either payroll or paying their rent or their utility bills, things along that lines. We're also heartened to see the number of folks that are looking for some retrofit money. And some of that's relatively, I don't want to say nominal cost, because any cost to a business at this point that they weren't expecting is significant, but it could be a couple $1,000s or a couple $100s to put in place public health, the things that meet the public health needs. So these sorts of shields, you know, where if you're going to a small restaurant and they have to put in plexiglass or stickers on floors to show what social distancing is, these are the sorts of things that we're already seeing coming through.
Mm-hmm. Tom, as you know, someone who has been head of the chamber for so long, you hate to see that it has come during a circumstance like this, but it's not very often that a county can get this kind of money for helping businesses the way that this will. I mean, you have to feel very fortunate.
Yeah, as I said at the beginning, it really was the game changer for us. We had this plan in the works prior to knowing about the money, and so the elements of the plan are critical, we believe, in any county's ability to try to build up consumer confidence and provide assistance to businesses to get through this. But obviously the CARES Act funding directly to the county, and then the ability to work with the county commissioners was a very unique and fortunate game changer for our community. And it also, frankly, really mobilized the entire community beyond just the chamber and the Economic Development Company to recognize that this was a gift and that we wanted to make sure that we were spending this money as appropriately as possible with the most impact. So engaging our healthcare systems in that process was another key component, and equally so all of our senior living communities that were involved as a result of the money as well has been a real game changer for Lancaster County.
Lisa Riggs is president of the Lancaster County Economic Development Company, and Tom Baldridge is president and CEO of the Lancaster Chamber, talking about the Lancaster County Economic Recovery Plan. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for having us.
Keep up the work.
Thank you. Coming up on tomorrow's program, WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Shultes had a feature story earlier, I guess it was last year, where he talked about a young woman suffering from mental illness. Well, there's an update there, and some of it isn't, it's been pretty serious, and he's going to update us on that coming up on tomorrow's program.